by the three Kennedys. Once inside, can we snatch a rest?
Sure. Jump in the morning. We've all earned a break. How far are they, JB?
JB was peeking over the rim of the plateau. When a shot rang out, he didn't even move.
Still way off effective range. At least 3/4 of an hour, Ryan. They've slowed more than us. Going to be full dark before they get here, and they'll never break in the sectors without the number code. Impossible.
Glad we don't have to go anywhere near that big Earth shift. Home of the bleached Wrigleys.
Beware the lair of the white worm, my lad. Beware the jaws that bite and the claws that catch.
Yeah. Take an awful lot to get me around that part of the redoubt again.
Ryan pressed the number 3, then 5, and finally 2.
Open sesame.
The companions were filled with tense energy, knowing that the horrors of the past couple of weeks were safely behind them, and security lay just ahead.
What is it?
Ryan pressed the numbers again, and again. Nothing happened. The vast sextile entrance remained immovably locked against them.
Fire blast!
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands, narrated by Richard Rowan, with performances by Terence Acil Ford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King Williams, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, Karen Carbone, Casey Jones, Kate Torrey, James Konacek, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands number 19, Deep Empire. There wasn't time for much of a discussion or argument. JB summed it up for them.
Coburn won't risk coming closer. He knows we're well armed and hold the high ground. You can't get behind us. You can't get above us. They'll figure we're stuck up here like hogs on ice. So we got the dark hours on our side.
Fire blast. They can't easily get up at us. We can't move down from this place. Our only hope is for one of us to climb up the cliff face, get in through where the earth slip opened the interior corridor walls, and try and open up the sectors from inside. It'll have to be me.
But Dad, the worms.
Yes, Em, I know.
None of them could forget the worms. The traitor used to say that if a man was going to get hurt, then waiting wouldn't make it any better. Ryan left the walnut-stocked Steyr SSG-70 bolt-action rifle behind with the others, taking the 6-hour P226 snug in its holster, and his old and trusted 18-inch Panga in its oiled sheath on his left hip. His thin-bladed flensing knife was concealed in the small of his back. The snow was falling again with serious intent, settling on the rocks all around him, on the faces of his companions, and on the flaming hair of Christy Roth.
Take care, love.
Don't I always?
What if you can't get in? Or you can't make it to the main doors? Or you can't work the lock from inside? What then, Ryan?
Then you'll all have some tough decisions to make.
Doc shook him by the hand, his grasp surprisingly powerful for such an old man.
Test every foot and handhold, there's a good chap. Some mountain climbing fellow told me that back in about 1890. Was it 1980? I fear that I disremember.
I get the message, Doc. Thanks. Right. Here goes.
Once he was out of the shelter of the plateau, Ryan encountered the full force of the wind biting in from the north. It plucked at his long coat, ruffling the white fur that trimmed it, and made his good right eye water, probing under the patch across the raw, empty left socket. Despite the bitter cold, Ryan knew better than to try to climb with gloves on. Though his fingers were cold, he kept moving them, fighting off numbness. In the shrieking maelstrom of the blizzard, he couldn't see how far he'd climbed, nor how far there still was to go up the jagged face. His memory put the ascent at 200 or 300 feet. He moved cautiously, making sure that every foothold was secure, before shifting his boots to the next one, testing the crevices and outcrops of granite with his fingers. Ideally, he knew that he should always have either a foot and two hands on, or a hand and 2 feet. Logical advice didn't always help. Ryan was losing track of height, space, and time. He hadn't checked his wristwatch before leaving the others, but he guessed he'd been working his way up the side of the mountain for the better part of a half hour. Twice he'd slipped as icebound chunks of rock came loose under a foot or hand, sending him sliding yards down the cliff. The noise of the wind was constant, filling his ears, blurring his concentration. All around him there was a whiteout, snow swirling into his mouth and eye, the force of the blizzard threatening to pluck him into the abyss. Ryan paused and flattened against the stone, fighting for breath. It had occurred to him several minutes earlier that there was a serious risk of his climbing past the cleft in the granite face, going on up and up, blinded, trapped in the storm, doomed to scramble on until exhaustion in the weather brought his lonely ending. He tried to replay in his mind the look of the hillside when they stood outside the entrance doors of the redoubt and stared upward. It seemed to him that it might have been a little more to the right. But he knew well enough how conditions like this could totally addle a man's sense of direction. There had been a motor mechanic from Warwag 1, somewhere near the Big Lakes of the Northeast. He'd been plagued with a virulent dysentery and had disdained the common latrines, choosing instead to go a few yards into the surrounding forest. And the snows had swallowed him up. Only when the blizzard ceased, 36 hours later, had they found his frozen corpse, less than 50 feet from safety. Ryan steadied his breathing, trying to use the power of Gaia, the Earth Mother, that Christy had taught him. But it was so hard to concentrate. Just for a moment, the memories of the old Warwags brought a fleeting thought of Abe, his old friend who had chosen to go off into Deathlands to try to find whether the traitor was dead or alive. That had been how long ago? But Ryan's memory wouldn't function. All there was in the universe was cold and wind and an infinity of white. He was out of the blizzard. Ryan found himself lying down, his knees drawn up under his chin, a thread of frozen spittle linking him to the stone, to concrete. It was entrancingly comfortable, warm. It felt so good that there was a temptation to simply lie there for a few more minutes and rest. Surely that couldn't do too much harm, could it? Maybe even sleep.
Fuck, no!
There wasn't a lot of sensation left in his hands, but he pummeled himself in the face, his eyes closed, kicking out with his frozen feet, forcing the pain of recirculating blood, his mouth open in a rictus of agony. Finally, he found that he could see, make out the dim shape of passage walls on either side of him, and a domed roof. He'd managed it, blundering into the redoubt by a heady mixture of luck and judgment. Ryan pulled himself upright and stared into the curving darkness of the corridor. That was the easy part. While he regained control over his body, Ryan checked his watch, shaking it and bringing the tiny numbers closer to his face, unable to believe what they showed. The whole climb had devoured less than 40 minutes. It took him nearly as long to be certain that his body was back to something approaching full combat readiness. He flexed his fingers and moved his head from side to side, falling to a crouch and then jumping up and kicking sideways. To anyone watching, he knew that he'd have presented a bizarre sight. But JB had once said that it was better to look stupid and stay alive than seem cool and be dead. Finally, feeling as ready as he could be, Ryan drew the panga from its sheath and readied himself to move toward the heart of the complex. It was still bitingly cold, his breath feathering out in front of him, and he could hear the distant roaring of the gale fading away behind. He picked his way along the sweep of the passage, taking the greatest care to stay in the center, away from the pitted walls and their lethal inhabitants. He'd reached a point where some of the overhead lights were functioning, casting a sepulchral pallor over the place. One or two of the tiny set cameras were also working, their lenses flicking from side to side, miniature ruby lights glowing. From his memory, Ryan knew that he would soon be reaching the region where the walls had been honeycombed by the white worms. If he could get past that section in safety, he would pass the entrance to the Matrans unit, then on into the heart of the military redoubt, and down to try to open the doors to his waiting companions. He stopped and glanced behind him. There had been a small noise, like a footfall, or metal touching the ice-sheathed walls. but the curve of the corridor was enough to limit his vision to less than 50 yards. Ryan waited for a moment, then carried carefully on, occasionally glancing behind him. If he was lucky, then he might not disturb the murderous worms. Now he could see the first signs of their